There's a beautiful story in Mark where Jesus comes up and there's a man who's blind, and he takes him aside and he puts saliva on his eyes and he says, "Now what do you see?" And the man says, "Well, I see, but people look like trees waving in the breeze." And so Jesus has to touch him a second time. You know, it was a two-treatment miracle. Well, Matthew doesn't like that at all. There's no way Jesus isn't going to heal everybody instantly. The fact that Jesus would just half heal somebody, Matthew has a stroke. He just drops that miracle completely. Mark is teaching something. Mark is saying, listen, if Jesus is touching you with the vision of faith, if he's removing the blindness that you have, don't think it's complete. There's more to be done. When he did it physically, this man didn't see clearly. You're not seeing Jesus clearly when he starts touching you this way, probably. Let him keep working upon you. And that vision, the vision of who Jesus is, your experience of Jesus will get deeper and deeper and deeper. So the miracle is told not to tell you that, hey, one day Jesus wasn't all with it. He got up and, you know, he got up on the wrong side of bed and he was feeling the blahs. So when he went to cure somebody, he only half worked. Mark's telling you that when Jesus is touching you, it's a constant process and it isn't over, and your vision will ever become more clearly. So he went to something Jesus did to help us understand, much more important, something about what Jesus is doing for us at this moment. Occasionally, now this next statement you might find a little bit disturbing. These individuals, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, will take a story and they'll change it to make the picture of Jesus that they are experiencing more accurate. Now, we would find that distorting history, and therefore we would find it, I can't think of the word, it's wrong. Their understanding would be the opposite. Not to change the story is wrong, because to tell the story through the eyes of what was seen as it happened is to miss Jesus, who is Lord of history, and not therefore to really communicate all that Jesus is. And not to communicate everything that Jesus is wrong, and it is false. The true significance of Jesus is seen only from the resurrection. Nobody believed. Now, this is kind of important, just a little bit of common sense that a lot of us, I never thought about it until a short while ago. Nobody believed that Jesus was God until Easter Sunday. Pilate would be an idiot to order God to death. Ananias would just be a boob to order God to death. Okay, so they didn't. Peter would have been dumb to deny God because he couldn't stand up to some woman. Sure, Jesus would be out of his life for 3 days, but if he's God, he's got to know he's going to be with him. Judas would never sell God. Nobody's that dumb. The rest who abandoned Jesus would never have done it. The crowd isn't going to shout for the death of God. They might believe that he was the Messiah and didn't like the way he was saving, the word Messiah. You don't have to be God. Nobody thought that God would come himself to be the Messiah. So only on Easter Sunday, that's why everybody's so shocked. You know, they come and they tell the disciples that the tomb's empty and they don't believe it. They come and they tell the disciples that they've seen Jesus and they don't believe it. And after all this, then ten of the disciples see Jesus and the 11th doesn't believe it. Why? Because they didn't know that he was God. They were just so shocked. So when they discover that Jesus is not only Christ, but that he's Lord, that changes everything. Every single thing that he did. And to bring out the real significance of what he's doing, you got to throw in more details that show more than Jesus ever could. Because until Easter, nobody could have related to him if they knew that he was God. If he ever claimed to be God, they'd have to kill him as Jews, right at the spot. So he couldn't bring out this part of himself. So they've got to show what is really happening then to show what is really happening now. And this is the real Jesus, and this is the way that it was.
So they will change details. All you got to do to see this, and I'm sharing this with you, I wouldn't tell you many things that were unnecessary that would be shocking, except if you ever start reading the gospel seriously, you're going to see that the same event is reported in different ways. And you're going to wonder who was right and who was wrong. Mark takes an event, and his main purpose is to use that event to help you understand Jesus who lives, who is acting upon his life. And he'll mold that event, and he'll drop parts of what happened, and he'll add things that didn't happen to help you understand what Jesus is really doing now for you and for me in his church. Three areas that I've come up with that are important to know about the writing of a gospel. And we'll look at each of these individuals briefly, Matthew, Mark, and Luke certainly, in this way. They have all this material over here. Now their understanding of Jesus is going to help them to see what they select and omit. What do they pick and what don't they pick? For example, there is in Luke something called the great omission. Mark writes first, and then Matthew and Luke have Mark, and they follow Mark. But Luke drops one whole big batch running right at a row of Mark. He has a reason for doing it. Where do they put the material? And then how do they tell it? How do they present the material itself? Let me explain each of these briefly. Look, here's all this mass of material that Mark has. He doesn't pick it all. Some of it won't help his experience of Jesus. He's heard people tell stories that just don't turn him on at all. He just picks certain ones. And he omits others. Don't need this one at all. It doesn't help. It won't go into his gospel. Then when he takes the story, he puts them in a certain order because the order itself helps unfold the explanation, the understanding of Jesus. I'll go through this in a moment, looking at Matthew, Mark, Luke, definitely to help you see the order. Where a story is put is very important. Why does he run controversy stories in a row here? Why does he have so many... I'm thinking of something that's really funny. Why does he have the stories of the two feedings, feeding 5,000 and feeding 4,000, and they seem to duplicate one another? There's a whole series of stories that just seem to duplicate. Jesus feeds 5, he feeds 4. After he feeds the 5, he crosses the sea. He crosses the sea after the 4. Then there's a controversy with the Pharisees. There's a controversy with the Pharisees. There's a discussion about bread. There's a discussion about bread. Why? They really seem to be the same basic story told in two different communities that came into Mark, and he uses them both. Was Mark such a dumbbell he didn't see he was telling the same story twice? Mark's a genius, and he has a very good reason for telling it. And I think it's kind of funny. So, and he puts them one right after another. He doesn't separate them so you might forget that you, boy, you know, this sounds like where I came in. Is this instant replay or something? He runs them right after one another. So you can't miss what he's doing. Where is the material put? And then how? How is a particular story shaped? We can't really tell too much with Mark. We don't know what he omits. We do know what he picks. But we don't know what other material was on hand. We do know where he puts things. He's writing first, okay? Sometimes we can't be sure how he molds the material. There are sections that we're pretty sure Mark puts sort of, he's responsible for everything there, little scenes that unite the story together. They really say, if you look at Mark's gospel, it's more like a photograph album. He has a picture of Jesus on a day, and then another picture of Jesus, and then another picture of Jesus, and he kind of gives you some little events that are happening in between and kind of ties it together so it'll have some story together. But how does he mold? But once you get through with Mark, then things become very interesting. Because, now this is what was available to Mark. Matthew and Luke have something additional to that. They now have Mark's gospel with the stories that he's picked, where he put them, and how he tells them. Now, if Matthew adds a story, why is he adding material? Why is he adding it here? Not only why is he selecting new stuff, why is he putting it here, and why is he telling it this way? We also can see, why does he drop something that Mark has? We could tell now when he doesn't want a story. I gave you the one where he drops the story about the blind man. And we know why. It helps us see Matthew's understanding. Matthew's Jesus is great. And he can't do anything in half measure. So Matthew can't put that story in. It's in Mark. He's got to drop it out. Why does he color a story? Why will he change how it's told? Why will he change? Matthew gets a thing from Mark where Jesus... I wish I could remember what happens here. I'm blocking out a little bit. Something then happens. Oh, Jesus is done in Galilee. And Mark then says, Jesus gets ready to leave Galilee. Great crowds gather to him, and he teaches them. That's what Mark says. Great crowds gather, and Jesus teaches. Now, Matthew takes that and he changes two words. See, now that we know that Matthew had Mark, we can look at Mark, and wherever there's changes, Matthew has a reason. Because the easiest thing is you just copy Mark, and he often will. If he changes a word, there's a reason for it. Instead of the crowds gathering, the crowds follow. Now, the crowd, the word crowd in Matthew's gospel is sort of... it's a word that means the future church. People who aren't in the church yet, but one day they will. They're those people who are open. Anybody open is going to be part of the church. And it's important for them to follow Jesus, not just to gather, but to follow Jesus on a journey to Jerusalem. The other word is much more important. Mark said that Jesus taught these crowds. Matthew changes that word to heal. For Mark, the mission of Jesus is to teach. He teaches by who he is. He really tells us something about God. When you see Jesus teaching a crowd, this is what God wants to do. He wants to come into your heart and really let you know that he's here to save you and to help you. Matthew doesn't like that. Jesus is so much more than teacher. Jesus is present to heal you. That's what he wants to do. And so Matthew will change the word just to reflect his own understanding. It's much more important for Matthew that the Lord is in your life to heal, body, soul, and spirit, your hurts. This is his real mission. He preaches in order to heal. He teaches in order to heal. And he can only teach in the church, so he changes the word. So, how a story is told for Matthew and Luke. All we got to do, we can look at Mark. And if Mark tells the same story, every change starts helping us understand the unusual way that Matthew and Luke experienced Jesus. What stories did they pick? Where did they put them? And how do they shape the individual story itself? Those will be the clues. As I shared with you, just to review again, each of these three people will experience Jesus differently. Mark experiences a Jesus who is dying. And he's telling us, look, don't try to just live the glory. The greatest mystery, one that we have no answer for, is why did anyone start writing a gospel? Since everybody gospeled by their life, why did Mark create this whole form? Why did he write it out? One answer is, Mark's community is experiencing the first persecution that has ever existed in the church. Mark's group of Christians were people who had been living the power of Jesus. They were experiencing Jesus. They were going forth and working miracles. They were healing people of sicknesses. And all of their attention was focused on Jesus as resurrected. They're riding the crest of the wave, the power of Jesus to heal. Nobody's ever going to stand in their way. And the first thing they know, the Roman government lands on them and is killing them. And if you're living the glory of Jesus, you can't take persecution. And it knocked the foundation out from under his community. Mark experienced a Jesus of suffering. And he saw that until the resurrection, nobody knows Jesus. And he warns his community, if you're trying to live the resurrection without the crucifixion, you don't know Jesus. You don't experience Jesus until you see him dying. The glory of Jesus is the result of the dying of Jesus. And so he writes a gospel to quickly look ahead. The gospel of Mark has very little of what Jesus says. It is 40% the dying of Jesus, the passion. 60% introduction, and that's not much. You know, you take everything that happened in 3 days is 40%. Or 7 days at most, if you want to take that, of his whole gospel. That's why scholars call Mark a passion with an introduction. So, the humanity of Jesus is very much stressed. If you're going to accent a Jesus who dies, then you look at all of his human traits. How he gets flustered because people won't let him save him. The Pharisees are blind and it upsets Jesus because he's been sent to save him. Matthew experiences a very different Jesus. His Jesus is the living Lord. He drops all of these human traits. He's above it all. His divinity is very strongly stressed. And Matthew's Jesus is a Jesus guiding his community. There's problems in the church itself. The first great persecution is ended. The persecution isn't the problem. The synagogue is. The Jewish faith is really lambasting Matthew's church, but they're not killing people as much. But there's deep problems here, and inside the community there's false teachers, and so you need the Spirit of Jesus to guide us in how we relate to one another, and that's to see the love of Jesus. So Jesus is one who comes in. He does teach us. He teaches us how once he heals us, we should live his healing love in our relations with one another. Luke comes up with a Jesus who loves the unlovables, the untouchables, women, the poor, sinners, pagans. John has a Jesus who's Lord, who replaces everything with his old self. I'd like to go through now and try a little bit to work this through, to take Mark and show in some ways what he omits, I mean what he selects. We don't know what he omitted because we don't know what he had, where he puts things and how he tells his story, and then to do the same quickly for Matthew and Luke to help you understand how in everything it's Jesus that they're telling, communicating. Matthew takes the passion. He has a few collections that he uses and a lot of isolated stories. He gives these stories an organization by time and by geography. He's got to put them in a before and after. But he does it basically by geography. I'm going to start off with the time, but he forces the time when things happen to fit in to where they happen. There's three parts to the ministry of Jesus. Every so often I get a little mature and walk to the back and see how bad the boards will look and figure I'll never write again. But up here, this map is just ever so clear. And then when I walk back there, it dawns on me that from back there, it sure is. Where my hand is the whole area of Galilee. It's almost entirely covered by my hand up here. And the Sea of Galilee here. That's where Jesus does all of his teaching in Mark. Then when he's done teaching, he starts a journey to Jerusalem. That's down in Judea. That's this area between my two hands. The journey isn't very important in Mark. And he gets to Jerusalem. And when he gets to Jerusalem, within 8 days, he's dead. There are three parts, really, to the gospel. What happens in Galilee, a few things for the journey, and then what happens in Jerusalem. Now, the greatest accent is on what happens in Jerusalem. Galilee is the place of revelation. Incidentally, there's a little bit of thought that I told you that the time is going to be forced by the geography. Some people are figuring that everything important, really, that Jesus does except his dying, his real revealing is done in Galilee. Well, that's across the tracks. That's the wrong side of the tracks. Because
Mark is really wanting to build up the church in Galilee and to show how much Jesus did there. That's where Jesus doesn't appear to anybody in Jerusalem in Mark's gospel on Easter after he dies. He dies and he tells his disciples, go to Galilee, you'll meet me there. He starts his revelation there and he ends his revelation there. He starts showing the light of God to people there, and when the full light comes after Easter, it's back to Galilee. So the geography is crucial in that one sense, so that all of the revealing, any story about Jesus doing deep teaching, has to happen in the first part of the ministry before Jesus leaves Galilee. And therefore, much of what Mark will show in the early part, where he puts things, the before and after, is done by a geographical basis. He wants Jesus to make the real big insights in the early part. So there's an organization by time. He begins with the public ministry. Nothing happens. Nothing is told about Jesus as a child. Nothing is told about Jesus before, as a full, mature adult, he starts announcing that God's power is breaking into our world, when Jesus is actually saving. Presumably, everything then happens in 1 year. This is where his geography affects his time. Jesus is only going to go to Jerusalem once, and a good Jew was supposed to go to Jerusalem really 3 times a year. But Jesus only goes to Jerusalem once for the Passover, which means he would have been there every year, that the whole public ministry in Mark occurs in 1 year. And Matthew and Luke use the same framework. Now, if I asked most of you, if you remembered from school, how long the public ministry of Jesus lasted, this is why you can't write a life of Jesus. You'd say 3 years. Because in John, Jesus goes up 3 times for the Passover. But if you're going to write a life of Jesus from Mark, it's all 1 year. Because he only... See, Mark's geography is teaching something. And I wish I could share more, but I haven't got that deep into Mark yet to find the geographical part. In my sharing with Mark, we haven't left Galilee yet, so we're right on the verge. So I don't know precisely the full distinction that he uses between all three parts. But anyway, the geography is important. He only goes to Jerusalem once, and there to die. It's sort of a negative view of Jerusalem, definitely. So it all occurs in 1 year. So time is forced into geography, and geography is used to teach theology. Now, where does he put things? He puts things in a place by geography, as I told you, starting in Galilee, with a journey, going to Jerusalem. He'll put things in a certain order. You might remember I was sharing a moment ago how he gives us the stories of the duplicate events. Where something is put is important. If you take a story out of context and read it the way we do for a Sunday gospel, you're going to miss Jesus. You might come up with a teaching, but you're going to miss so much of what Jesus is really communicating through Mark. You might remember I laughed. Mark wants to tell us how the disciples are dumb. They don't understand Jesus at all. They're no different from the Pharisees in Mark's gospel. No matter what Jesus does. So, the disciples are with Jesus in a wilderness area with a crowd of 5,000. And Jesus says, what am I going to do? The disciples don't know. They don't believe Jesus could feed them. Jesus feeds them. They get in a boat. Jesus walks across the water. They're in trouble. Jesus walks across the water. They're scared of him. They don't even recognize him. They still don't understand Jesus, and he saves them. There's a discussion where, I forgot what the first discussion, Jesus declares all food, all bread clean. And then Jesus works a very important miracle, giving a person who is stuttering the ability to speak. It's important in that it's comes from a section of Isaiah that shows that the Messiah is here. And there's two things, this miracle and this miracle will balance. All of this has been with the Jews. In Matthew and Luke, Jesus never sets foot outside of Jewish territory. But it's very important for Mark to show that Jesus wants to heal pagans also. So Mark has no stories of Jesus ever setting foot on pagan soil, but he wants the pagans to know that Jesus loved them. So he takes this second cycle and he makes it now a pagan cycle. First, a woman who is pagan comes to Jesus and she says, "Heal my son," and Jesus does. Jesus is in the same area and now he's with 4,000. Now you might be able to start getting the picture a little bit. Jesus is out in a wilderness area with 4,000 people and they're hungry. And the disciples don't have any idea what Jesus can do. You might think they'd remember seeing it the first time. That's that. The fact that I'm Polish means I like Polish jokes. You know, that's like they tell about the Polak who lost $5 on a football game and another $5 on the replay. Well, that's the disciples. You're laughing. That's why I chuckled here. 5,000, wilderness, don't know what you're going to do, Jesus. 4,000, wilderness, don't know what you're going to do, Jesus. There's a crossing. There's a debate with the Pharisees. And then Jesus gets into a boat with his 12 disciples. So you have the 12 disciples and one loaf of bread. And they're upset because they don't have enough bread. Now Mark's trying to just pound into your head how dumb they are. Here they are with the man who fed 5,000 in a wilderness, 4,000 in a wilderness. They're getting into a boat with them, they have one loaf of bread, and they're worried. We don't have enough bread. You just read that story, you're going to miss the whole meaning. You read it all in the flow. You see where it's put. And what Mark is saying, listen, no matter how much you see Jesus acting, you can't understand him. Now you're going to understand the next miracle is Jesus working that double miracle on the man who's blind. Nobody can understand Jesus unless Jesus opens their eyes. And immediately after that, Peter says, "You are the Christ." And you know that when Peter is saying, "You are the Christ," that's the first time that's said in the gospel, that can't come from Peter, because Peter would have to, he'd be back in the wilderness 50 times, betting on the replays, wondering how Jesus was going to feed. Because man can never understand God. We can't see Jesus. Only Jesus can give us this insight, and when he starts, there's ever more to be done. So where a story is put makes all the difference in the world. Got another one to show you with Matthew, very much the same. How it's told will then also make the difference. For example, the duplicate stories. Jesus feeds 5,000. Jesus feeds 4,000. The 5,000 are fed from 5 loaves of bread. The 4,000 are fed from 7 loaves of bread. There's 12 baskets left over from the 5,000, and there's 7 baskets left over from the 4,000. And it's all symbolic, the numbers, how the numbers are changed. This is the feeding of Jews. The Jews are God's people. God's people are that group of people whose origin is told. You'll need this for Matthew, so please remember it for just a moment or two. The origin of God's people is told in the first 5 books of the Bible, the first 5 scrolls, the Torah, the Pentateuch. 5 books form them, so there's 5,000. They're fed from the 5 loaves of bread, are responsible for the feeding. 12 loaves are left over. There are 12 tribes. There are 12 disciples who are the new patriarchs of the new 12 tribes of the new Israel. There's got to be enough for the 12 disciples to continue feeding God's people. In this instance, they are told to sit down in groups of 50 or 100. Because this is the new Israel, and Jesus is the new Moses, and the old Moses in the wilderness area, when God was feeding his people with manna, organized them in groups of 50 and 100 so he could rule them better. Jesus is taking care of them here, and Jesus teaches them. This is the pagan feeding. Remember the second feeding? Pagans are those who come from the four corners of the world, or are brought by the four winds, however you want to put it. In the early church, there's a story about how the non
Hebrew-speaking Christians weren't having their needs taken care of by the 12. So they ask for seven deacons are appointed. Seven are appointed to take care of them. That's the number of seven. Seven loaves, therefore, satisfying them, also representing the 70 nations that the book of Genesis kind of counts everybody in the world. There are more, but the Bible teaches everything. There are 70 nations there. Seven baskets left over representing the seven deacons who are to feed the 70 nations. So how the story is told teaches theology. Who is Jesus? Jesus is the real bread of life, teaching and feeding the Jews and the Gentiles, the old Israel and all of God's children. And just take the one story where Jesus fed a group in a wilderness, and by changing numbers, new theology is taught and points are made. So how the story is told certainly affects what's being told. And the numbers can be very, very significant. Matthew is telling us, remember, Mark is telling us that nobody can understand Jesus until he dies. Jesus gives Peter some insight, but after Peter says, "You're the Christ," he still is stupid. He's just unbelievably stupid in Mark's gospel, and that's very important that they continue not to stand by Jesus, not to understand Jesus. Mark begins with a phrase, "This is the gospel, the good news of Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God." There's a characteristic of Jewish writing where it's called inclusion. When you don't have writing, and you got to remember things, I said of writing, of storytelling. One way to shut your memory off is you start and end something with the same basic thought or words, so that you start it with those words and then you got to work your memory, and then when you use the same phrase, you know you can shut your memory off and you can relax, you're at the end. The moment that Jesus dies, now we've just gone through a whole gospel where nobody really understands Jesus. The Jewish leaders reject him, they kill him. His disciples abandon him. The moment that Jesus dies, a pagan, a Roman soldier, one who's not believing in God, seeing Jesus die, he doesn't run, so he's present when Jesus dies, looks at the cross and he says, "Truly, this is the Son of God." The phrase that opened the gospel. This is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The moment of his death, it's all brought together. Truly, this is the Son of God. The first person who sees Jesus, and he sees him in dying, the first person who really sees the whole Jesus is a pagan. But that's simply not the fact that he's pagan isn't important. It's the man at the foot of the cross. He's experienced Jesus dying. So he now can say who Jesus is. So that phrase helps us understand what Mark is trying to communicate. Jesus lives, but Mark doesn't tell us anything about the resurrection. Some women go to the tomb. They find the tomb empty. Jesus tells them to go to his disciples and tell them to get to Galilee. And the women take off and they're terrified and they tell no one. And that's where the gospel that Mark wrote ends. There's more added on by someone else later. There's not a single appearance of the resurrected Jesus, because probably Mark doesn't want to bring the spotlight back on the glory of Jesus. His community suffered because they were trying to live the resurrected Jesus with his power too much and ignoring the dying Jesus. Now, Jesus lives. The gospel ends with the resurrection, but the glorified Jesus touches nobody yet, because that could, in Mark's telling, upset what he really wants to share, the way he's trying to help people. Mark is a genius as a storyteller. He gives us very little of the teaching of Jesus. The very first thing he has Jesus do, Jesus goes into a synagogue once he starts his real ministry, and everybody is spellbound at his teaching, and Mark never tells us a word of what Jesus says. And then he works a healing. Very often when Jesus works a healing, everybody praises Jesus as teacher. In everything that Jesus is, he is teaching. The greatest teaching, therefore, comes in the crucifixion. Jesus is teaching us how to experience what he's doing for us today, and that's to be open to Jesus as he dies. So
material he selects is material that helps us understand Jesus dying. Also shows that Jesus is Lord. He puts things in a specific order to tell us that until Jesus dies, and until we're willing to experience Jesus as dying in our own life, we're not going to really understand who Jesus is. And in the telling, he'll shape events to bring this out. So that's for Mark. Once Mark is written, remember, Matthew now has something else. Matthew not only has a passion story, Matthew has something down here, a whole collection of the sayings of Jesus, this same group, and he has Mark itself. What Matthew does is he takes Mark, he adds an introduction, stories about Jesus as a child, he adds a conclusion, stories of the resurrected Jesus touching people. Then he takes the collection of the things that Jesus says and he organizes them. And he breaks in five times to the gospel to give us a collection of Jesus doing and then a sermon. Jesus doing and then a sermon. Jesus doing and then a sermon. So what you have is, not counting the introduction and the conclusion, you have five booklets. And the very organization is telling us that Jesus is the new Israel. The old Israel had its story told. Remember, I asked you to just remember that one fact. In the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible told how God formed a people to himself. God is forming a new Israel, and we have five booklets. Each one consisting of a narrative and a sermon. And we know that there's five booklets, five sermons, because each sermon ends with pretty much the same phrase. I'm going to have to erase this part. Because of the what Mark is doing, he's got to drop out a lot of the little details. I mean, Matthew has to drop out the details of Mark. He's adding so much material, it would have been too long. So he drops out things just refining them, smoothing them down. It's not important. Mark will tell you that the blind man that Jesus gives sight to is called Bartimaeus. Matthew drops it. It doesn't make any difference what the man's name is. The man whose daughter Jesus brings back from the dead. There's only two people come back from the dead. Well, only one in Matthew's gospel. And Matthew doesn't tell you it's a girl. Matthew doesn't tell you the father's name. He had it from Mark, but that's not important. Cut it down. Cut out anything that's unimportant. Help people understand what Jesus is doing for them and what Jesus is doing for them at this moment. In all probability, well, the community of Matthew is threatened in two ways. There's problems inside, false teachers, and there's a little bit of discord. So the sermons are brought in to tell the community how the Spirit of Jesus is a spirit of love, and touched by that spirit of love, how they should be able to love one another. Also, the church has been thrown out by the synagogue. The best example I've come up with on this is, in the United States and in the world at this moment, there's a movement called the Charismatic or Pentecostal movement, where people are open to, in a full way, the Spirit of Jesus touching their life. In the Catholic Church, we respect this movement. Most liberal Protestant churches do also. The Southern Baptist Church does not. There are several others, but I want to use the Southern Baptist Church because they've acted. In the charismatic movement, people have a very deep personal experience of the Spirit of Jesus. Some Southern Baptists have had this. Having had it, having known then that Jesus is teaching them in a real way, they're thrown out of the Southern Baptist Church. And that just really shakes them, because they've spent their whole life in the Southern Baptist Church. They've believed in it. Their whole living of Christianity was based upon it. It still seems to be the way they're supposed to live Christianity. Now they're having a Jesus experience, and they're being thrown out of their church. Well, this is exactly what happened to the early church. And for Matthew, Matthew's community is Jewish in background. They spent their whole life going to the synagogue. Now, all of a sudden, they've been thrown out of the synagogue for believing in Jesus as Messiah, and the synagogue is cursing them every service. And their roots are broken, and they're hurting. And Matthew is speaking to them. It's trying to show them that the synagogue is wrong. They're not. So the synagogue represents the Pharisees, and Jesus represents the church. And we're going to see again and again he shows how the Pharisees are wrong. The Pharisees are ignorant. Jesus is right. It's not because Jesus is wrong that the Pharisees rejected him. Therefore, it isn't because the church is wrong that the church is rejected. Before I get that, I told you that Matthew's a bookkeeper. I'm going to show you a little example of this. I use the word inclusion. There's another pattern of writing called chiasmus. Chiasmus is you refer to something as, let me see how many I need. E. You refer to something, and then A, B, C, D, E, F, then you pick them up in a reverse order, and you come back down, so that when you reach A again, you can shut your memory off. Like that would be like talking about apples and bears, and then you talk about bears and then apples. When you're back to apples, you can stop. The whole Gospel of Matthew is one of the most intricate, arranged forms of this that you can possibly find. Five booklets, each booklet with its sermon. It all centers around the middle sermon, which is a series of parables, half delivered to everybody, half to the church alone, and that's a very important turning point. That's the third sermon. That deals with the coming of the kingdom. The second sermon deals with Jesus sending the church out on a mission. The fourth sermon, so the church is sent out. The fourth sermon, and the second and fourth are about the same length, tells us what to do in the church with those in the church that Jesus sends to us. Second sends the church out. The fourth tells us how to receive those that Jesus, not just the world, sends into us. The first sermon, I'll skip some, deals with God's kingship breaking into our life for the first time. The Sermon on the Mount, telling us how radical what God is doing really is. The fifth sermon, and they're both much longer, this would be the first and the fifth, talks about the final breaking in of God's kingship into our life, the last days. So there's a similar theme and a similar length. Before that, we have a reference to the baptism of Jesus. After that, we have the baptism, the real baptism of Jesus. Can you drink of the cup of which I am to drink? And I have a baptism I'm yearning for. That's his death. So you have a reference to the death of Jesus. The first, very first quote in the gospel is the name of Jesus from the Old Testament. Jesus is called Emmanuel. That means God with us. The very last words of Jesus in the gospel is, full authority has been granted to me both in heaven and on earth. Go therefore, teach all nations, baptize all nations, teaching them everything I have commanded you, and know that I am, here's the big phrase, know that I am with you always until the end of the earth. The last sentence, I am with you, the first quote, God is with us. You can shut your mind off, the gospel's ended. It's one huge, and you can carry this out much, much more than I have. God with us, baptism, God with us. Just look at the five sermons. There are deeper arrangements within. So the whole gospel has been given an artificial arrangement to help people remember. The five booklets are to teach us that we're watching the formation of the new people of God in Jesus. Jesus is the new Moses. The stories of the infancy of Jesus are to show that Jesus is a new Moses and a new Israel. Moses had to be saved as a child. Jesus has to be saved as a child. We see why there has to be a new Israel. The first Moses had to be saved from a pagan ruler. The second Moses has to be saved from the leader of Israel, King Herod, and taken down to pagan Egypt to save his life. Jesus then retraces the journey of Israel. Matthew does this. The last reference you have before Jesus starts his public ministry, Jesus is in Egypt. Out of Egypt, Israel came through the water. It spent 40 years in the desert, the wilderness, and then where it got at Mount Sinai, the law. Jesus comes out of Egypt. He passes through the Jordan. He spends 40 days in the wilderness and then goes up on the mountain and gives us the new law. The way it's organized is to show that Jesus is the new and greater Moses. Following this, the second narrative, Matthew pulled together 10 miracles. He just has Jesus from the mountain given us the new law. So he's Moses as lawgiver. But Moses was also the one who worked the 10 great acts in Egypt to free God's people from slavery. Right after this, we have 10 miracles.